and keeps your relationship with them alive longer. Storing books. Put all your books on the floor. Once you have finished organizing and storing your clothes, it's time to move on to books. Books are one of three things that people find hardest to let go. Many people say that books are one thing they just can't part with, regardless of whether they are avid readers or not. But the real problem is actually the way in which they part with them. One of my clients, a woman in her 30s who worked for a foreign consulting firm, loved books. She had read not only every business book, but also a broad range of novels and manga. Naturally, her room was filled with books. She had 3 large ceiling-height bookshelves full of books, plus about 20 waist-high towers of books piled precariously on the floor. When walking through the room, I had to sidestep and twist to avoid bumping into them. I said to her what I say to all my clients. Please start by removing every book from your shelves and putting them all on the floor. Her eyes grew round.
All of them? There's an awful lot.
Yes, I know. All of them, please.
But...
She hesitated for a moment as though searching for words before continuing.
Wouldn't it be easier to choose them while they're still on the shelf and I can see the titles?
Books are usually arranged in rows and bookcases so that their titles are clearly visible. So it does seem to make more sense to weed out those you don't want when you can see them. Not only that, but books are heavy. Taking them all off the shelf only to put them back on again seems like a waste of effort. Even so, do not skip this step. Remove all the books from your bookcases. You cannot judge whether or not a book really grabs you when it's still on the shelf. Like clothes or any other belongings, books that have been left untouched on the shelf for a long time are dormant. Or perhaps I should say they're invisible. Although in plain sight, they remain unseen, just like a praying mantis still in the grass, merging with its surroundings. Have you ever experienced that jolt of surprise when you suddenly notice it there? If you ask yourself, does this spark joy, when you are just looking at the things on your shelves or in your drawers, the question won't mean much to you. To truly decide whether you want to keep something or to dispose of it, you must take your things out of hibernation. Even the piles of books already on the floor will be easier to assess if you move them to a different part of the floor or restack them. Just like the gentle shake we use to wake someone up, we can stimulate our belongings by physically moving them, exposing them to fresh air and making them conscious. While helping my clients tidy their homes or offices, I stand in front of the mound of books they have piled on the floor and clap my hands, or I gently stroke the book covers. Although my clients look at me strangely at first, they are inevitably surprised at how quickly and precisely they are able to choose after this. They can see exactly what they need and don't need. It is much harder to choose books when they are still on the shelf, which means you will have to repeat the process later. If there are too many books to arrange on the floor all at one time, I ask my clients to divide them into 4 broad categories. General, books you read for pleasure. Practical, references, cookbooks, etc. Visual, photograph collections, etc. Magazines. Once you have piled your books, take them in your hand one by one and decide whether you want to keep or discard each one. The criterion is, of course, whether or not it gives you a thrill of pleasure when you touch it. Remember, I said when you touch it. Make sure you don't start reading it. Reading clouds your judgment. Instead of asking yourself what you feel, you'll start asking whether you need that book or not. Imagine what it would be like to have a bookshelf filled only with books that you really love. Isn't that image spellbinding? For someone who loves books, what greater happiness could there be? Unread books. Sometime means never. The most common reason for not discarding a book is, I might read it again. Take a moment to count the number of favorite books that you have actually read more than once. How many are there? For some, it may be as few as 5, while for some exceptional readers, it may be as many as 100. People who reread that many, however, are usually people in specific professions, such as scholars and authors.
Very rarely will you find ordinary people like me who read so many books. Let's face it. In the end, you are going to read very few of your books again. As with clothing, we need to stop and think about what purpose these books serve. Books are essentially paper, sheets of paper printed with letters and bound together. Their true purpose is to be read, to convey the information to their readers. It's the information they contain that has meaning. There is no meaning in their just being on your shelves. You read books for the experience of reading. Books you have read have already been experienced, and their content is inside you, even if you don't remember. So when deciding which books to keep, forget about whether you think you'll read it again or whether you've mastered what's inside. Instead, take each book in your hand and decide whether it moves you or not. Keep only those books that will make you happy just to see them on your shelves, the ones that you really love. That includes this book, too. If you don't feel any joy when you hold it in your hand, I would rather you discard it. What about books that you have started but not yet finished reading? Or books you bought but have not yet started? What should be done with books like these that you intend to read sometime? The internet has made it easy to purchase books, but as a consequence, it seems to me that people have far more unread books than they once did, ranging from 3 to more than 40. It is not uncommon for people to purchase a book and then buy another one not long after, before they have read the first one. Unread books accumulate. The problem with books that we intend to read sometime is that they are far harder to part with than ones we have already read. I remember one incident where I was giving a lesson to a CEO on how to clean his office. His bookshelves were filled with difficult-sounding titles that you might expect a company president to read, such as classics by authors like Drucker and Carnegie, as well as the latest bestsellers. It was like walking into a bookstore. When I saw his collection, I had a sinking feeling. Sure enough, when he began sorting them, he put one book after another on his to-keep pile, announcing that they were still unread. By the time he finished, he still had 50 volumes and had barely made a dent in the original collection. When I asked why he kept them, he gave the classic answer from my list of most probable answers. Because I might want to read it sometime. I'm afraid that from personal experience I can tell you right now, sometime never comes. If you missed your chance to read a particular book, even if it was recommended to you or is one you have been intending to read for ages, this is your chance to let it go. You may have wanted to read it when you bought it, but if you haven't read it by now, the book's purpose was to teach you that you didn't need it. There's no need to finish reading books that you only got halfway through. Their purpose was to be read halfway. So get rid of all those unread books. It will be far better for you to read the book that really grabs you right now than one that you left to gather dust for years. People with large book collections are almost always diligent learners. This is why it's not unusual to see many references and study guides in my clients' bookcases. Those most commonly left unread in Japan are English textbooks, practical English conversation handbooks for travelers, and useful business English phrasebooks. Handbooks and guides for acquiring qualifications are often incredibly diverse, ranging from bookkeeping, real estate, and computer qualifications to aromatherapy and color coordinating. Sometimes I am amazed at the type of qualifications my clients are interested in. Many of my clients also keep their old textbooks all the way back to junior high and notebooks for practicing writing skills. So if, like many of my clients, you have any books that fall into this category, I urge you to stop insisting that you will use them someday. Get rid of them today. Why? Because the odds are very low that you'll ever read them. Of all my clients, less than 15% put such books to use. When they explain why they hang on to them, their answers are all about what they intend to do someday. I'd like to study this someday. I'll study it when I have a little more time. I thought it would be useful to master English. I wanted to study bookkeeping because I'm in management. If you haven't done what you intended to do yet, donate or recycle that book. Only by discarding it will you be able to test how passionate you are about that subject. If your feelings don't change after discarding it, then you're fine as is.
If you want the book so badly after getting rid of it that you're willing to buy another copy, then buy one. And this time, read and study it. Books to keep. Those that belong in the Hall of Fame. I now keep my collection of books to about 30 volumes at any one time, but in the past, I found it very hard to discard books because I love them. The first time I sorted through my library using the yardstick of whether or not they gave me joy, I had about 100 volumes left in my bookcase. Although this is not excessive compared to the average, I felt that I could still reduce. One day I decided to take a closer look at what I had. I started with books that I considered taboo to discard. In my case, first on the list was Alice in Wonderland, which I have read repeatedly since grade one. Books like this, which fall into one's personal book hall of fame, are simple to identify. Next, I looked at books that inspired pleasure but didn't quite make it into the Hall of Fame. As time passes, the content of this category naturally changes, but these books are the ones I definitely want to keep right now. At that time, one of these was The Art of Discarding, which first opened my eyes to tidying, although I no longer have it. Books that provide this degree of pleasure are also fine to keep. The most difficult ones are those that give you moderate pleasure, those with words or phrases that moved your heart and that you might want to read again. These are the hardest to discard. Although I felt no pressure to get rid of them, I could not overlook the fact that they only gave me moderate pleasure, particularly not when I was pursuing perfection in the field of tidying. I began to search for a way to let them go without regret, and eventually hit upon what I called the bulk reduction method. Realizing that what I really wanted to keep was not the book, but certain information or specific words it contained, I decided that if I kept only what was necessary, I should be able to part with the rest. My idea was to copy the sentences that inspired me into a notebook. Over time, I thought, this would become a personal collection of my favorite words of wisdom. It might be fun to read it over in the future and trace the path my interests had led me. With great excitement, I pulled out a notebook I liked and launched my project. I began by underlining the places I wanted to copy. Then I wrote the title in my notebook and began transcribing. Once I started, however, I realized that this process was far too much work. It takes time to transcribe, and if I was going to be able to read those words in the future, my handwriting had to be neat. To copy 10 quotations from a single book would take at least half an hour, and that was a low estimate. The thought of doing this for 40 books made me dizzy. My next plan was to use a copy machine. I would copy the sections I wanted to keep and cut and paste them into my notebook. This, I thought, should be much quicker and easier. But when I tried it, it was even more work. I finally decided to rip the relevant page out of the book. Pasting pages into a notebook was also a pain, so I simplified the process by slipping them into a file instead. This only took 5 minutes per book, and I managed to get rid of 40 books and keep the words I liked. I was extremely pleased with the results. 2 years after launching this bulk reduction method, I had a sudden flash of realization. I had never once looked at the file I created. All that effort had just been to ease my own conscience. Recently, I have noticed that having fewer books actually increases the impact of the information I read. I recognize necessary information much more easily. Many of my clients, particularly those who have disposed of a substantial number of books and papers, have also mentioned this. For books, timing is everything. The moment you first encounter a particular book is the right time to read it. To avoid missing that moment, I recommend that you keep your collection small. Sorting papers. Rule of thumb. Discard everything. Once you've finished organizing your books, it's time to move on to your papers. For example, the letter holder bursting with envelopes that hangs on your wall, the school announcement stuck to your fridge, the unanswered invitation to your school reunion lying by the phone, the newspapers that have accumulated on your table over the last few days. There are several spots within the house where papers tend to pile up like snowdrifts. Although the general assumption is that there are far fewer papers in the home than in the office, this is actually not true. The minimum amount of paper my clients discard or recycle is 2 45-liter bags. The maximum, so far, is 15 bags. I don't know how many times I hear my clients' paper shredders jam. It is extremely difficult to manage such a large volume of paper, yet I occasionally meet some amazing clients whose filing skills take my breath away. When I ask, "How are you managing your papers?" their explanations are extremely thorough. Papers related to the children go in this file. That file there is my recipe file. Magazine clippings go in here, and manuals for my electric appliances go in this box. They have categorized their papers in such fine detail that my mind sometimes wanders off in the middle of their discourse. I confess, I hate filing papers. I never use multiple files or write labels. This system perhaps works better in an office setting, where many people use the same documents, but there is absolutely no need to use such a detailed filing system in the home. My basic principle for sorting papers is to throw them all away. My clients are stunned when I say this, but there is nothing more annoying than papers. After all, they will never inspire joy, no matter how carefully you keep them. For this reason, I recommend you dispose of anything that does not fall into one of the three categories: currently in use, needed for a limited period of time, or must be kept indefinitely. The term papers, by the way, does not include papers with sentimental value like old love letters or diaries. Attempting to sort these will slow down your pace drastically. Limit yourself at first to sorting papers that give you no thrill at all, and finish the job in one go. Letters from friends and lovers can be left for when you tackle sentimental items. Once you've gone through those papers that don't evoke any pleasure, what should you do with the ones that you've decided to keep? My filing method is extremely simple. I divide them into two categories: papers to be saved and papers that need to be dealt with. Although my policy is to get rid of all papers, these are the only categories I make for those that can't be discarded. Letters requiring a reply, forms that need to be submitted, a newspaper that I intend to read. Make a special corner for papers like these that need to be dealt with. Make sure that you keep all such papers in one spot only. Never let them spread to other parts of the house. I recommend using a vertical organizer in which papers can be stored standing up and designating a specific place for it. All papers requiring attention can be placed in here without separating them. As for papers that must be saved, these I subdivide according to the frequency of use. Again, the way I divide them is not complicated. I organize them into infrequently used papers and more frequently used papers. Infrequently used papers include insurance policies, guarantees, and leases. Unfortunately, these must be kept automatically, regardless of the fact that they spark no particular joy in your heart. As you will almost never need to access papers in this category, you don't have to put a lot of effort into storing them. I recommend putting them all into a single, ordinary, clear plastic folder without worrying about further categorization. The other subcategory consists of papers that you will take out and look at more frequently, such as the outlines of seminars or newspaper clippings. These are meaningless unless they are stored in a way that's easy to access and read, which is why I recommend inserting them into the book-like pages of a clear plastic file folder. This category is the trickiest of them all. Although papers like this are not really necessary, they tend to multiply. Reducing the volume of this category is key to organizing your papers. Papers are organized into only three categories: needs attention, should be saved, contractual documents, and should be saved, others. The point is to keep all papers in one category in the same container or folder, and to purposely refrain from subdividing them any further by content. In other words, you only need three containers or folders. Don't forget that the needs attention box ought to be empty. If there are papers in it, be aware that this means you have left things undone in your life that require your attention. Although I have never managed to completely empty my needs attention box, this is the goal to which we should aspire. All about papers. How to organize troublesome papers. My basic policy is to discard all papers, but there are always going to be some that are hard to get rid of. Let's consider here how to tackle these. lecture materials. Those who enjoy studying are quite likely to attend seminars or courses in various subjects, such as aromatherapy, logical thinking, or marketing. The recent trend in Japan is to utilize time in the early morning to take seminars. The content and time frame are broadening, giving people a wide choice. For the participants, the materials diligently produced by the lecturer are akin to a badge of honor, and as such they are hard to part with. But when I visit the homes of these ardent learners, I find that these materials usurp much of the room, making their space oppressive. One of my clients was a woman in her 30s who worked for an advertising company. The moment I entered her room, I felt like I was in an office. My eyes were assaulted by rows of files with carefully printed titles. "These are all materials from the seminars I took," she told me. A self-confessed seminar fanatic, she had saved and filed the materials from every seminar she had ever attended. People often insist, "I want to restudy these materials sometime," but most never do so. Moreover, the majority of them usually have materials for multiple seminars on the same or similar subjects. Why? Because what they learned at the seminars did not stick. I am not saying this as a criticism, but merely to point out why it isn't worth keeping materials from past seminars. If the content is not put into practice, such courses are meaningless. A seminar's value begins the moment we start attending, and the key to extracting the full value is putting what we learn there into practice the moment the course ends. Why do people pay expensive fees for such courses when they can read the same content in a book or elsewhere? Because they want to feel the passion of the teacher and experience that learning environment. Thus, the real material is the seminar itself, and it must be experienced live. When you attend a seminar, do so with a resolve to part with every handout distributed. If you regret recycling it, take the same seminar again, and this time apply the learning. It's paradoxical, but I believe that precisely because we hang on to such materials, we fail to put what we learn into practice. The biggest collection of seminar materials I have come across so far was 199 files. Needless to say, I had her discard every single one. Credit card statements. Another thing to discard are all your credit card statements. What is their purpose? For most people, they are simply the means of checking how much money was spent on what during a particular month. So, once you've checked the content to confirm that it's correct and have recorded the figure in your household account book, the statement has fulfilled its purpose and you should discard it. Trust me, you need feel no guilt at all. Can you think of any other time that you would really need your credit card statements? Do you imagine that you might need them for a court case to prove how much was withdrawn? That's not going to happen, so there is no need to treasure these statements for the rest of your life. The same is true for notices of withdrawals from your account to pay utility fees. Be resolute and take this opportunity to get rid of them. Of all my clients, the ones who had the hardest time disposing of papers were a couple, both of whom were lawyers. They kept asking, "What if this document is needed in court?" At first, they made very little progress, but in the end, even they were able to discard almost all their papers without experiencing any problems. If they can do it, so can you. Warranties for electrical appliances. Whether a TV or a digital camera, all electrical appliances come with a warranty. This is the most standard document category in any home, and the one that almost everyone files and saves properly. The method of organizing, however, is usually almost but not quite right. In general, people save their warranties in clear folder files or accordion-style files. The attraction of these files is that the documents can be stored in separate compartments. However, therein lies their pitfall. Because they are so well divided, it is easy to overlook things. Most people save not only the warranty but also the operation manual in the same file. First, let's start by parting with these manuals. Take a look at them. Have you ever used them? In general, there are only a few manuals that we actually need to read, such as our computer or digital camera manual, and these are so thick that they won't fit in a file anyway. So basically, Any manuals contained in your warranty folder can be discarded without causing any difficulty. To date, all my clients have discarded most of their manuals, including those for their PCs and cameras, and none of them has experienced any problems from doing so. If they have a problem, they can usually fix it themselves by fiddling with the machine, and they can find solutions for anything they can't figure out on their own from the internet or the place of purchase. So I assure you, you can dispose of them without any qualms. Getting back to warranties, the filing method I recommend is to put them all in a single clear file, without separating them into categories. Warranties are only used once a year, if at all. What point is there in carefully sorting and separating them when the odds that they will be needed are so low? Moreover, if you filed them in a file folder, you'll have to flip through the pages to find the right warranty. In that case, it's just as easy to keep them all in one file, pull out the entire stack, and search through it. If you sort in too much detail, it means you will have fewer opportunities to look at each warranty. Before you realize it, the warranty will be out of date. If you have to sift through them all when you need one anyway, this becomes an excellent opportunity to check the expiration dates of your other warranties. This way, you don't have to go to the trouble of deliberately checking the contents just for the expiration dates. And often, you don't even have to buy the clear file in which you store the warranties because there is usually at least one already in the house. Finally, this method takes up a tenth of the space of conventional methods. Greeting cards. In Japan, it is the custom to send New Year's cards to convey New Year's greetings. Many have lottery numbers at the bottom. This means that each card has fulfilled its purpose the moment the receiver finishes reading it. Once you've checked to see whether the numbers on your cards have won anything in the lottery, you can part with the cards with gratitude for conveying to you the consideration of the sender. If you save the cards to confirm the sending address for the following year, then only save 1 year's worth. Dispense with those that are 2 or more years old. Accept those that spark joy in your heart. Used checkbooks. Used checkbooks are just that. Used. You're not going to look at them again. And even if you do, it won't increase the amount of money in the bank. So, really, get rid of them. Payslips. The purpose of your payslip is to inform you how much you have been paid for this month. Once you've checked the content, its usefulness is over. Komono. Miscellaneous items. Keep things because you love them, not just because. I pull out a drawer in my client's home and discover a strange little box, just waiting to be opened, like a tantalizing book that promises some fascinating tale. But for me, there is no excitement whatsoever. I know exactly what I'll find inside. Loose change, hairpins, erasers, spare buttons, wristwatch parts, batteries that may or may not be dead, leftover medicine, lucky charms, key rings. And the list goes on. I already know what the client's answer will be if I ask why these things are in that box. Just because. Many items within the home are treated in the same way. They are placed, stored, and accumulate just because, without our giving them much thought. I call this category komono, a Japanese term that the dictionary defines variously as small articles, miscellaneous items, accessories, gadgets or small tools, parts or attachments, an insignificant person, small fry. It's no wonder people don't know what to do with things that fall into such a vague and all-encompassing category. Still, it's time to bid farewell to this just-because approach. These items play an important part in supporting your lifestyle, and therefore they, too, deserve to be handled one by one and sorted properly. Unlike clothes or books, this category includes a diverse range of items, and the thought of trying to sort and organize them may seem daunting. If you deal with them in the proper order, however, this task is actually quite simple. The basic order for sorting komono is as follows. 1. CDs, DVDs. 2. Skincare products. 3. Makeup. 4. Accessories. 5. Valuables. Passports, credit cards, etc. 6. Electrical equipment and appliances. Digital cameras, electric cords, anything that seems vaguely electric. 7. Household equipment. Stationery and writing materials, sewing kits, etc. 8. Household supplies. Expendables like medicine, detergents, tissues, etc. 9. Kitchen goods, food supplies. Spatulas, pots, blenders, etc. 10. Other. Spare change, figurines, etc. If you have many items related to a particular interest or hobby, such as ski equipment or tea ceremony articles, treat these as a single subcategory. I recommend this particular order because it is easier if you start with more personal items and clearly defined content first. If you live alone, you don't really need to worry about the order as long as you do one subcategory at a time. Too many people live surrounded by things they don't need, just because. I urge you to take stock of your kimono and save only, and I mean only, those that bring you joy. Common types of kimono. Disposables. A surprising number of things are instantly identifiable as disposable without even asking, does this spark joy? I have already pointed out how important it is to relinquish the things that you find it hard to part with. It is equally important when putting your house in order to actually notice the things you have kept, for no particular reason. The majority of people are surprisingly unaware of the odds and ends taking up space in their homes. Gifts. A plate received as a wedding favor that still sits in its box on top of the china cabinet. A key holder you received as a souvenir from a friend that now lies in your drawer. A set of peculiar-smelling incense presented to you by your colleagues on your birthday. What do these items all have in common? They were gifts. Someone important to you used precious time to pick them out and buy them for you. They are an expression of love and consideration. You can't just throw them away, right? But let's consider this more carefully. Most of these gifts remain unopened or have been used only once. Admit it. They simply don't suit your taste. The true purpose of a present is to be received. Presents are not things, but a means for conveying someone's feelings. When viewed from this perspective, you don't need to feel guilty for parting with a gift. Just thank it for the joy it gave you when you first received it. Of course, it would be ideal if you could use it with joy. But surely the person who gave it to you doesn't want you to use it out of a sense of obligation, or to put it away without using it, only to feel guilty every time you see it. When you discard or donate it, you do so for the sake of the giver, too. Cosmetic samples saved for trips. Do you have a collection of cosmetic samples that have been hanging around for a year or more unused? Many people keep these to use on trips, but then never seem to take them when they travel. I contacted various manufacturers to inquire about the shelf life of these products. The answers were varied. Some only last a few weeks, while others are good for a year. When the quantity is very small, such as for samples, the quality deteriorates faster. To use possibly outdated cosmetics, especially when you are supposed to be enjoying your travels, seems rather foolhardy. Electronics packages. Boxes are surprisingly bulky. Discard or recycle the box your cell phone comes in as soon as you unpack it. You don't need the manual or the CD that comes with it either. You'll figure out the applications you need through using it. All of my clients have discarded these things, yet none of them has ever been inconvenienced by their absence. If you do have a problem, you can always get help from the internet or the clerk at the shop where you bought it. It is far quicker to ask a pro for the answer than to struggle to find one in the manual by yourself. Some people save the boxes for electrical appliances because they think they can get more money for the appliances if they ever sell them. This, however, is a waste. If you consider the rent or mortgage you pay, turning your space into a storage shed for empty boxes costs you more than what you could earn selling an appliance in a box. You don't need to keep them for moving, either. You can worry about finding suitable boxes when the time comes. It's a shame to let a boring box take up room in your house just because you might need it someday. Unidentified cords. If you see a cord and wonder what on earth it's for, chances are you'll never use it again. Mysterious cords will always remain just that, a mystery. Are you worried you might need it if something breaks? Don't be. I have seen countless homes with duplicates of the same type of cord, but a tangle of cords just makes it harder to find the right one. In the end, it is quicker to buy a new one. Keep only those cords that you can clearly identify and get rid of the rest. Your collection most likely contains quite a few that belong to defunct machines you have long since discarded. Broken appliances. I often come across broken TVs and radios in my clients' homes. Obviously, there is no need to keep these. If you, too, have broken appliances, see this as an opportunity to contact your local recycler and get rid of them. Bedding for the guest who never comes. Quilts, pillows, blankets, sheets. Spare sets of bedding take up a lot of room. This is another common item that gets discarded during my lessons, and again, my clients rarely miss it. Although it's worth having spare bedding if you have regular guests, it's unnecessary to keep extra sets if you only have overnight visitors at most once or twice a year. Bedding stored indefinitely in the closet often smells so mildewed you wouldn't want to let your guests use it anyway. Take a whiff and see for yourself. Spare buttons. You will never use spare buttons. In most cases, when a button falls off, it's a sign that the particular shirt or blouse has been well worn and loved, and has now reached the end of its life. For coats and jackets that you want to keep for a long time, I recommend sewing spare buttons to the lining when you first buy them. For other clothes, if you lose a button and really want to replace it, you can always get what you need at a large handicraft shop. From my work in the field, I have come to the conclusion that when a button falls off, people often don't bother to sew another one on even when they have kept the spares. Instead, they either keep wearing the outfit without a button or leave it lying around somewhere in their wardrobe. If you're not going to use spare buttons anyway, it shouldn't matter that you get rid of them. Products from the latest health craze. Slimming belts, glass bottles for making kefir, a special blender for making tofu, a weight loss machine that mimics the movement of horseback riding. It seems a waste to get rid of expensive items like these that you bought by mail order but never fully used. Believe me, I can relate. But you can let them go. The exhilaration you felt when you bought them is what counts. Express your appreciation for their contribution to your life by telling them, "Thank you for the boost you gave me when I bought you," or, "Thank you for helping me get a little more fit." Then discard them with the conviction that you are healthier for having bought them. Free novelty goods. A cell phone screen cleaner that came with a soda bottle. A ball pen engraved with your school's name. A paper fan you got at an event. A set of plastic cups won at a fair. Glasses bearing a beer company's logo. Post-its stamped with the pharmaceutical company's name. A folder with just 5 sheets of blotting paper. A promotional calendar, still in its tube. A pocket calendar, unused even 6 months into the year. None of these are going to bring you any pleasure. Discard or recycle them without any qualms. Small change. Make into my wallet your motto. Do you have loose change lying around? A penny or two in the bottom of your purse? A dime in the back of a drawer? A quarter on the table? I always find coins when I'm helping clients put their house in order. The king of the komono category, coins can be found in the entrance hall, the kitchen, the living room, the washroom, on top of furniture, and inside drawers. Despite the fact that coins are perfectly good cash, they are treated with far less respect than paper money. It seems strange that they should be left lying around the house where they are of no use at all. Whenever my clients come across loose change during tidying, I make sure it goes straight into their wallets, never into a piggy bank. Unlike the other categories, you don't need to gather coins from every part of the house. Instead, Just pop them into your wallet whenever you stumble on them. If you put them in a piggy bank, you are simply transferring the place where they will be ignored. People who have lived in the same house for a long time are particularly prone to forgetting about their little cache of coins. Frankly, no one I've met who saved pennies without a clear purpose has ever actually used them. If you are saving coins with the vague idea that it would be nice to see how many you can accumulate, now is the time to take them to the bank. The longer you wait, the heavier your cash will be, and the more bother to take it to the bank. I have also noticed that for some unfathomable reason, many of my clients start saving coins in bags when their piggy bank is full. Years later, during my course, they stumble across a bag bursting with coins in the back of a cupboard. By that time, it is pungent with the smell of rust and mold. The coins are discolored, and they make a dull clinking sound instead of jingling. At this point, my clients would rather just ignore the bag's existence. Writing this description is hard enough, but to actually see these coins, stripped of their dignity as money, is heart-rending. I beg you to rescue those forgotten coins wasting away in your home by adopting the motto, "Into my wallet." Sentimental items. Your parents' home is not a haven for mementos. Now that you have organized your clothes, books, papers, and kimono, you can finally tackle the last category, items that have sentimental value. I leave this for last because these are the hardest things to discard. Just as the word implies, mementos are reminders of a time when these items gave us joy. The thought of disposing of them sparks the fear that we'll lose those precious memories along with them. But you don't need to worry. Truly precious memories will never vanish, even if you discard the objects associated with them. When you think about your future, is it worth keeping mementos of things that you would otherwise forget? We live in the present. No matter how wonderful things used to be, we cannot live in the past. The joy and excitement we feel here and now are more important. So, once again, the way to decide what to keep is to pick up each item and ask yourself, does this spark joy? Let me tell you about a client of mine whom I'll call A. She was a 30-year-old mother of two in a 5-member household. When I visited her house for our second session, it was obvious that the number of things in her home had decreased. "You really worked hard," I said. "It looks like you must have gotten rid of about 30 bags worth of stuff." Looking very pleased, she said, "Yes, I did. I sent all my keepsakes to my mother's place." I could hardly believe my ears. She had used the "send it to my parents" method of tidying. When I first started this business, I actually thought that being able to send things home was the privilege of people who came from large houses in the country. The majority of my clients were single women or young mothers living in Tokyo. If they asked permission to send things to their parents' house, I said, "Sure, as long as you do it right away." I never thought anything of this until my clientele expanded to homes in rural towns. When I learned the true state of parents' houses, I was forced to retract my rash words. Now I realize that people who have a convenient place to send things, such as a parent's house, are actually quite unfortunate. Even if the house is large with rooms to spare, it is not some infinitely expanding fourth dimension. People never retrieve the boxes they send home. Once sent, they will never again be opened. But let me get back to my story. Sometime later, A's mother started taking my course. I knew that if she were to graduate, we would have to do something about the luggage A had sent home. When I visited the house, I found that A's room had been left untouched. Her things filled the bookcase and the closet, and now there were two big boxes parked on the floor. Her mother's dream was to have a space of her own in which she could relax, but even though A had moved out long ago, with her things still enshrined in her room, the only space her mother felt was hers was the kitchen. This seemed very unnatural. I contacted A and announced, "You and your mother won't graduate from this course until you have both dealt with the stuff you left at your parents' house." On the day of her last lesson, A looked extremely happy. "Now I can enjoy the rest of my life free from care." She had gone back home and put her things in order. In the boxes, she had found a diary, photographs of old boyfriends, a mountain of letters and New Year's cards, and more. I was just fooling myself by sending the things I couldn't bear to part with to my parents. When I looked at each item again, I realized that I had lived those moments to the fullest, and I was able to thank my keepsakes for the joy they gave me at the time. When I threw them away, I felt like I was confronting my past for the first time in my life. That's right. By handling each sentimental item and deciding what to discard, you process your past. If you just stow these things away in a drawer or cardboard box, before you realize it, your past will become a weight that holds you back and keeps you from living in the here and now. To put your things in order means to put your past in order, too. It's like resetting your life and settling your accounts so that you can take the next step forward. Another item that is just as difficult to discard is keepsakes from one's children. A Father's Day present with the words, "Thanks, Dad." A picture your son drew that was selected by the teacher to hang in the school hall, or an ashtray your daughter made. If these things still bring you joy, it is fine to keep them. But if your children are already grown and you are keeping them because you think discarding them will hurt your children's feelings, ask them. They are quite likely to say, "What? You still have that? Go ahead and get rid of it." And what about things from your own childhood? Do you still keep your report cards or graduation certificates? When my client pulled out a school uniform from 40 years ago, even I felt my heart constrict with emotion. But it still should be disposed of. Let all those letters you received years ago from a girlfriend or boyfriend go. The purpose of a letter is fulfilled the moment it is received. By now, the person who wrote it has long forgotten what he or she wrote and even the letter's very existence. As for accessories you received as gifts, keep them only if they bring you pure joy. If you are keeping them because you can't forget a former boyfriend, it's better to discard or donate them. Hanging on to them makes it more likely that you will miss opportunities for new relationships. It is not our memories, but the person we have become because of those past experiences that we should treasure. This is the lesson these keepsakes teach us when we sort them. The space in which we live should be for the person we are becoming now, not for the person we were in the past. Photos. Cherish who you are now. If you have been sorting and discarding things in the order I recommend, you have likely stumbled across photographs in many different places, perhaps stuck between books on a shelf, lying in a desk drawer, or hidden in a box of odds and ends. While many may already have been in albums, I'm sure you found the odd photo or two enclosed with a letter, or still encased in the envelope from the photo shop. I don't know why so many people leave photos in these envelopes. Because photos tend to emerge from the most unexpected places when we are sorting other categories, it is much more efficient to put them in a designated spot every time you find one, and deal with them all at the very end. There is a good reason to leave photos for last. If you start sorting photos before you have honed your intuitive sense of what brings you joy, the whole process will spin out of control and come to a halt. In contrast, once you have followed the correct order for tidying, as in clothes, books, papers, kimono, sentimental items, sorting will proceed smoothly, and you will be amazed by your capacity to choose on the basis of what gives you pleasure. There is only one way to sort photos, and you should keep in mind that it takes a little time. The correct method is to remove all your photos from their albums and look at them one by one. Those who protest that this is far too much work are people who have never truly sorted photos. Photographs exist only to show a specific event or time. For this reason, they must be looked at one by one. When you do this, you will be surprised at how clearly you can tell the difference between those that touch your heart and those that don't. As always, only keep the ones that inspire joy. With this method, you will keep only about 5 per day of a special trip, but this will be so representative of that time that they bring back the rest vividly. Really important things are not that great in number. Unexciting photos of scenery that you can't even place belong in the garbage. The meaning of a photo lies in the excitement and joy you feel when taking it. In many cases, the prints developed afterward have already outlived their purpose. Sometimes people keep a mass of photos in a big box with the intention of enjoying them someday in their old age. I can tell you now that someday never comes. I can't count how many boxes of unsorted photographs I have seen that were left by someone who has passed away. A typical conversation with my clients goes something like this. What's in that box? Photos. Then you can leave them to sort at the end. Oh, but they aren't mine. They belonged to my grandfather. Every time I have this conversation, it makes me sad. I can't help thinking that the lives of the deceased would have been that much richer if the space occupied by that box had been free when the person was alive. Besides, we shouldn't still be sorting photos when we reach old age. If you, too, are leaving this task for when you grow old, don't wait. Do it now. You will enjoy the photos far more when you are old if they are already in an album than if you have to move and sort through a heavy box full of them. Astounding stockpiles I have seen. There are two surprises I frequently encounter when helping clients put their houses in order. Highly unusual items and sheer numbers. I come across the first every time. It might be a music machine used by a singer, or the latest cooking utensils owned by someone who loves to cook. Every day provides exciting encounters with the unknown. This is only natural, as my clients' interests and professions are extremely diverse. The real shock is when I discover a massive stockpile of a simple item that you would find in any home. As we work, I always jot down the rough volume of different items my clients own, and particularly keep an eye on my stockpile ranking for different items because new records are constantly being made. Once, for example, I discovered a huge stock of toothbrushes in a client's home. The record up to that point had been 35. Even that collection seemed large. "Perhaps you have a few more than you need," I remarked, and we enjoyed a little laugh together. But the new record far surpassed the old. This client had 60 toothbrushes. Arranged in boxes in the cupboard under the sink, they looked like a work of art. It's interesting how the human mind tries to make sense, even out of the nonsensical. I found myself pondering whether she would go through one a day if she brushed her teeth too hard, or if perhaps she used a different brush for each tooth. Another surprise was a stock of 30 boxes of plastic kitchen wrap. I opened the cupboard above the kitchen sink to find it completely filled with an array of what looked like large yellow Lego blocks. "I use plastic wrap every day so it goes down fast," my client explained. But even if she used one box a week, that supply would last her over half a year. Regular size wrap comes in 20-meter rolls. To use up one roll a week, you would have to cover an 8-inch diameter plate 66 times, even allowing for rather generous use. Just the thought of repeating the action of pulling and tearing plastic wrap that many times would give me carpal tunnel syndrome. As for toilet paper, the record stock so far is 80 rolls. "I have loose bowels, you see. I run out very quickly," was the client's excuse. But even if she used one roll a day, she had at least a 3-month supply. I'm not sure she could have used up one roll a day, even if she spent all day wiping her bottom, and by that time her bottom would have been rubbed raw. It made me wonder whether I should be giving her skin cream rather than lessons in cleaning. The ultimate record, however, was a stockpile of 20,000 cotton swabs, a cache of 100 boxes with 200 swabs each. If my client used one swab a day, it would take her 55 years to use up her supply. By the time she had finished, she might have developed amazing techniques for cleaning her ears. The last swab used on the last day would appear almost sacred. You may find these accounts hard to believe, but I'm not kidding. The strange thing is that these clients never realized how many items they actually had until they began putting their house in order. And even though they owned a huge stockpile, they always felt as if they didn't have enough and were anxious about running out. For people who stockpile, I don't think there is any amount that would make them feel secure. The more they have, the more they worry about running out, and the more anxious they become. Even though they still have 2 left, they will go out and buy 5 more. Unlike a shop, if you run out of something at home, it's not a big deal. It may cause you temporary stress, but it does no irreparable damage. But how should we handle these stockpiles? Although the best solution would appear to be to use all the items up, in many cases they are past their expiration date and must be thrown out. I highly recommend that you get rid of excess stock all at once. Give it away to friends who need it, recycle it, or take it to a donation shop. You may think this is a waste of money, but reducing your stock and relieving yourself of the burden of excess is the quickest and most effective way to put your things in order. Once you've experienced the freedom of a life without surplus stock, you won't want to give it up and will naturally stop stockpiling. My clients tell me that now life is more fun, because when they run out of something, they enjoy seeing how long they can last without it, or trying to substitute other things. It's important to assess what you have on hand now and eliminate excess. Reduce until you reach the point where something clicks. Sort by category, in the correct order, and keep only those things that inspire joy. Do this thoroughly and quickly, all in one go. If you follow this advice, you will dramatically reduce the volume of things you own, experience an exhilaration you have never known before, and gain confidence in your life. What is the perfect amount of possessions? I think that most people don't know. If you have lived in Japan or the United States all your life, you have almost certainly been surrounded by far more than you need. This makes it hard for many people to imagine how much they need to live comfortably. As you reduce your belongings through the process of tidying, you will come to a point where you suddenly know how much is just right for you. You will feel it as clearly as if something has clicked inside your head and said, "Ah, this is just the amount I need to live comfortably. This is all I need to be happy. I don't need anything more." The satisfaction that envelops your whole being at that point is palpable. I call this the just right click point. Interestingly, once you have passed this point, you'll find that the amount you own never increases. And that is precisely why you will never rebound. The click point differs from one person to another. For a shoe lover, it might be 100 pairs of shoes, while a book lover might not need anything but books. Some people, like me, have more loungewear than clothes for going out, while others may prefer to go naked in the home and therefore have no loungewear at all. You'd be surprised at how many fall into this latter category. As you put your house in order and decrease your possessions, you'll see what your true values are, what is really important to you in your life. But don't focus on reducing, or on efficient storage methods for that matter. Focus instead on choosing the things that inspire joy, and on enjoying life according to your own standards. This is the true pleasure of tidying. If you have not yet felt a click, don't worry. You can still reduce. Tackle this job with confidence. Follow your intuition and all will be well. Choose those things that spark joy when you touch them. Hang those clothes that would be happier on hangers. Don't worry about throwing away too much. There will come a moment when you know what is just right. If you have listened this far, you have probably noticed that in my method, your feelings are the standard for decision-making. Many people may be puzzled by such vague criteria as things that give you a thrill of pleasure or click point. The majority of methods give clearly defined numerical goals, such as discard anything you haven't used for 2 years, 7 jackets and 10 blouses is the perfect amount, get rid of one thing every time you buy something new. But I believe this is one reason these methods result in rebound. Even if these methods temporarily result in a tidy space, automatically following criteria proposed by others and based on their know-how will have no lasting effect, unless their criteria happens to match your own standards of what feels right. Only you can know what kind of environment makes you feel happy. The act of picking up and choosing objects is extremely personal. To avoid rebound, you need to create your own tidying method with your own standards. This is precisely why it is so important to identify how you feel about each item you own. The fact that you possess a surplus of things that you can't bring yourself to discard doesn't mean that you are taking good care of them. In fact, it is quite the opposite. By paring down to the volume that you can properly handle, you revitalize your relationship with your belongings. Just because you dispose of something does not mean you give up